Hello, and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Jonathan Taplin, professor at the University of Southern California Annenberg School for Communications. I'm sitting in for Ian Masters while he takes a rare and well-deserved vacation. We're going to begin and speak with Thomas Edsel, professor at the Columbia University School of Journalism, about his book, The Age of Austerity, How Scarcity Will Remake American Politics. We're then going to talk to Trevor Potter, who was a Republican FEC commissioner from 1991 to 1995 and has represented Stephen Colbert in front of the Federal Election Commission, and we'll talk about super PACs. And then finally, we're going to end up with Dave Lowry, who is the singer, songwriter, and guitarist for the legendary alt-indie bands Cracker and Camper Van Beethoven. And we're going to talk a little bit about music sharing, file sharing, advertising, and intellectual property. Joining us now is Thomas Edsel, a professor of journalism at the Columbia University and author of the book, The Age of Austerity, How Scarcity Will Remake American Politics, which is recently out in paperback. He has an article at the New York Times entitled, Is Rush Limbaugh's Country Gone?, which really fascinated me. Tom, you wrote this recent column quoting Rush Limbaugh on the morning after the election. Rush said, I went to bed last night thinking we're outnumbered. I went to bed last night thinking all this discussion we'd had about this election being the election that will tell us whether we or not we've lost the country. I went to bed last night thinking we've lost the country. I don't know how else you would look at this. So you go on in the column to basically state that this is true, that the hard right has lost the country. Can you talk a little bit about this?
Really, what I'm saying is that the culture war has been won, and the left has won the culture war. If you look at the votes on marijuana and gay marriage, there was an abortion vote in Florida. All of these were losses, and basically what's been happening is that the conservative Christian right kind of agenda helped the Republican Party really from the 1970s into the 1990s, became less and less valuable during the 90s, and now in this century, basically the country has flipped and is fundamentally liberal on the social issues, so that those questions are ones that the right just doesn't win on anymore. And I think you can see in a lot of the commentary from Republican consultants that they're fully aware of this problem.
So you go so far as to quote a recent Pew poll that said that a plurality of young people hold a favorable view of socialism and by a tiny margin a negative view of capitalism. So this is quite a turnaround for America, right? This is not what the mainstream media is telling us is what's going on.
Well, socialism remains to be, by the majority of all voters, is not favored by any means. But there is a much more sympathetic view towards socialism among those who are part of what is called the rising American electorate, the electorate that really put Obama into office. Among single women, minorities, young people, and Democratic liberals of all races, those groups which overlap extensively, there's a much more favorable view of socialism and a much more favorable view of an activist federal government in general, and a much more critical view of capitalism than the sort of right coalition holds. And those are the groups that are growing, and they are gaining strength in the electorate, so that over time, and in this last election, I think, they demonstrated majority power. Whether that in off years is another question. The Republicans did well in 2010, and they may well do in 2014. but the long-range trends are clearly favoring the liberal coalition, both economically and culturally. And it's unlikely that that's going to change, and this is going to probably be more and more applicable to presidential elections and, over time, to off-year congressional elections.
So this rising American electorate really is very much in favor of investing in education and infrastructure rather than cutting the social safety net. And yet the Republican House seems absolutely convinced that the only way out of this fiscal cliff situation is by cutting the safety net. How are we going to resolve this situation where you have a House completely in control by the Republican Party and a Senate and an executive branch that feels quite differently?
Well, a number of things. One, the Senate is more ambivalent on these. It includes a number of Democrats who are basically centrist to conservative-ish Democrats. So that it's not like a solid base of support. Secondly, Obama himself is kind of ambivalent on this subject, and he has shown a willingness to cut this social safety net. He certainly was during the bargaining in 2011 over the debt ceiling with John Boehner. So it's not entirely clear whether the views of the rising American electorate are going to be fully represented in the bargaining that we now are undergoing over how to deal with the fiscal cliff and the issues it raises. So in terms of policy, it's kind of a mixed bag at this point. And it's not like we haven't reached the tipping point on the policy end of things, except, I think, on the culture war things. I think it would be very difficult to enact a conservative cultural agenda of any kind at this point.
And yet, Rick Santorum this morning announced that he was thinking of running for president again. Is the Republican Party in total denial?
They clearly, it's going to be a very hard problem for the Republican Party. Going through an adjustment like this is very difficult when you have a party. It's like a corporation that's been building, say, big gas-guzzling cars, and it's got a whole corporate structure of people and employees and managers, all of whom are devoted to the idea of building cars that may no longer be sellable to the consumer. It's very hard to turn around a company like that. To some extent, the Republican Party is in the same situation where it has core constituencies. There's no way they can tell the Christian right, for example, take a walk. The Christian right provides 40% of the vote for Republican presidential candidates. And the economic conservatives who want to cut the social safety net, basically, comprise another significant portion of the Republican-based electorate. So it's the adjustment. How you deal with that is a very difficult process. And I think the Republican Party is really now just beginning to face that.
In your book, The Age of Austerity, which is out now in paperback, you argue that the most recent debates about policy are often trumped by fear. Isn't the very use of the term fiscal cliff an attempt to have fear dominate a recent debate? After all, in January 1 is going to come, and if we do nothing, January 2 will arrive, and there will be no great effect on our economy. It's not a cliff, is it? It's more like a slope. Is that a correct way of thinking about it?
I'm not an economist, so it's hard for me to judge. I don't know whether, for example, if we reach the point where taxes suddenly went up significantly so that middle-class people were paying a whole lot more, and you're taking all of that out of the marketplace, basically. And you have these very substantial $100 billion in cuts, half in domestic, half in military. Again, all money that goes into the marketplace, in a sense, and helps drive the economy you could see the stock market take a real nosedive, for example. And these things, the danger is, I agree with you that what's happened is, what's really happened is that Congress, through various legislative procedures, the way it wrote the sequestration legislation, the way it wrote the Bush tax cuts to attempt to theoretically expire, and the way the payroll tax cut expires on the, I think, the first of the year also. You have three things. They basically created what may be a fiscal cliff, but it is it's a man-made creation. It is not necessarily, it's not an economically created cliff, but it may well be a cliff regardless because of the, you could say, stupidity of the politicians who have created it and now are struggling to deal with it. It's also a cliff that clearly, I think, works to the advantage of conservatives because it does pose this threat of economic deterioration and the possibility of falling into recession again, and kind of forces the hand of government to address these budget-cutting proposals, which are very, it may well be not the right time to be doing that at all. Probably is not.
Well, Senator Patty Murray argues that it's just the opposite, that it plays to the hand of the Democrats, because after all, on January 1, the Bush tax cuts have gone away. So in terms of getting Republicans to have to vote for a tax cut on the wealthiest Americans, I mean, for to raise taxes on the wealthiest Americans would not have to happen anymore. Simply then you would raise the vote for to lower taxes on the middle class, and they could vote for that, and they still wouldn't have violated Grover Norquist's pledge. And obviously, if that happened in January or February, nothing really would have changed fiscally because the Treasury has some flexibility as to when they tell people to take higher with withholding taxes and stuff like that. Isn't there a simpler way out of this? Let all the cuts expire?
The problem with that strategy is the tax legislation, according to the Constitution, has to originate in the House. The Senate cannot take this action on its own, although there may be a floating around tax bill that they could use and convert it into that. But barring that, the House has to act first, and the problem is getting the House to act first. If the House could well propose a restoration of all the tax cuts, including on the wealthy, and send that to the Senate. It's true that the Democrats have some bargaining power in this. The only thing I would be wary about on that is Democrats have not shown great bravery on these fights in the past.
Why do you think that is?
Well, I'll tell you why. One basic thing is that a lot of Democrats have a lot of very wealthy constituents. And if you look at Wall Street, Silicon Valley, and Hollywood contributions, those are from very high bracket taxpayers. And they provide a very substantial sum of money to every member of Congress, including Democrats, running for Congress. Secondly, the practice has become increasingly, the practice of a member of the House or Senate retiring or losing election and then going on to becoming a lobbyist has become more and more prevalent. I think literally more than half of House members now go on and become lobbyists where they make much more money than they did as members of the House. So it's as if the career in the House is not like the culmination of someone's life, but just one step in the process. When you're looking forward to going to work as a lobbyist, your thinking is different than if you were contemplating retiring and going back to your district and becoming a sort of respected figure in the community. You're calculating on who's going to hire you. And I think that colors a lot of what goes on in Congress. The power of the wealthy has increased significantly. And as you get more and more unequal distribution of income, you're basically concentrating more and more power among a group that has a great deal vested in keeping their tax rates low. And if you look at especially Obama's 2008 campaign, I think of his top 10 contributors, about 8 of them were employees of Wall Street banking institutions. That number went down some in this last election because he was not quite so popular with Wall Street. But my point is that it's you have a rising American electorate. It's got a pretty distinct policy agenda or point of view. But the balance of power in Washington does not reflect that at this point.
So,
and that takes a long time to sink in.
Right. So, I mean, you've done a lot of history. I mean, obviously, one could look back to the progressive era at the turn of the 20th century, where Teddy Roosevelt and a coalition of people basically took on J.P. Morgan, Rockefeller, the moneyed interests. Do you think there's any hope that in a second Obama term, where he doesn't have to run for election, could be a more reform-oriented term to take on some of these issues you're raising?
Oh, I think it will be a more reform-oriented, but how much more so is another question we have yet to see. And Obama was very willing to compromise, and I think he has been throughout his presidency, even during his first 2 years when he was still pretty popular, he compromised extensively on the composition of the stimulus bill. He compromised extensively on the Dodd-Frank reforms, and he compromised considerably on his health care proposals, all in a vague and unfulfilled hope that he was going to get Republican support. He got zilch on all of those. Now, he may have learned from that. I don't know. I think he clearly is prepared to be tougher, but how much tougher, I just don't know.
What would be a sign for you, for instance, in a new Treasury Secretary or something, that he was willing to have a more reform-oriented agenda? Would it be cabinet appointments, or what would it take?
Well, I think he's got an issue that's coming up probably before he makes many or any possibly new cabinet appointments, which is this fiscal cliff issue, and how does he hang tough on the issue of raising rates on the rich, and is he willing to go to the wall on that like Patty Murray would like them to go? If he is, which he has said he is, then I think that is the real test of that'll be the big first real test, put it that way, of where he's going to go.
I want to remind my audience that I'm speaking with Tom Edsel, a professor of journalism at Columbia University and author of the book, The Age of Austerity, How Scarcity Will Make American Politics, just out in paperback. You mentioned in your Times piece the notion of a kind of welfare for the 1%. You said, in fact, the rising American electorate represents a direct threat to the striking array of government benefits for the affluent that the conservative movement has won over the past 40 years. These include the reduction of the top tax rate, the reduction on dividends, the lowering of estate taxes. Is this a kind of new rhetorical frame that would get libertarians to see that their interests would not necessarily rest with the Republican Party if we kind of framed it as the Republicans have been creating a welfare program for the 1%?
I think that if it can be described as, in effect, a kind of crony capitalism, and a concentration of power, that that could well appear to appeal to libertarians who are opposed to both of those. I mean, there's a libertarian economist at Chicago. I can't pronounce his name correctly, Luis Zingales.
Zanetti, yeah. Right?
But he really is, his main critique is of sort of crony capitalism, of people doing favors and avoiding the market. Insofar as what's been won for the affluent can be described as market distorting, which it is, I think that has a lot of effect. And it also sort of then has broad American appeal, not just to libertarians, but
right.
That was sort of Teddy Roosevelt's basic premise on antitrust legislation.
So this brings us back to this sequestration that you mentioned earlier.
Yep.
It would appear to me that these would be, if it went through, the first real cuts in military spending in over the last 70 years. Wouldn't that be a good thing to have happen, even if it was somewhat of a fiscal drag?
Well, they're accompanied by equal amounts of cuts across the board in social spending that exempts Social Security, Medicaid, Medicare, and I think food stamps. But there are a lot of other programs there that get cut, too. So it's not just as easy shot. Secondly, I think if you look, the data I've seen recently shows military spending as a percentage of GDP or GNP, whichever you want to use, as sort of going up every time there's sort of a war period, and then going down actually considerably after the Korean War, after the Vietnam War, and right now we're at a high point, and it certainly could go down considerably if it followed the same path as these previous lines have suggested. But again, cutting across the board in the way that the sequestration requires is not a wise way to cut anything. It's like cutting the top 10% of your house off from
right.
Roof down. I mean, it when maybe there are a lot of better ways to reduce your house size.
Right. Well, thank you so much for joining us today, Tom Edsel.
Thank you.
Again, we've been speaking with Thomas Edsel, professor of journalism at Columbia University and author of the book, The Age of Austerity, How Scarcity Will Remake American Politics. Okay, we're going to take a brief station break and be back with Trevor Potter and talk about Federal Election Commission.
It's the money.
What's my station? Oh, just tell me what I should do. I don't need to be kind to the armies of night that would do such injustice to you. Or bow down and be grateful and say, should
welcome back. I'm Jonathan Taplin, sitting in for Ian Masters. Joining us now is Trevor Potter, who was a Republican FEC commissioner from 1991 to 1995, serving as chairman in 1994. Washington-based lawyer, he has also represented Stephen Colbert and appeared on the Colbert Report to discuss election law and Colbert's super PAC. So, Trevor, you wrote a piece in the Washington Post last week that made it clear that the Federal Election Commission was as responsible as the Supreme Court for the super PAC disaster of the last election. Can you explain?
Right. What happened here is that the Supreme Court said that corporations could do unlimited independent spending. That's what they said in Citizens United. But they also said that that spending would be fully disclosed, however they did it, so that shareholders would know what their corporations were doing and could hold them accountable, and so that the rest of us, as we watched television ads, would know who was paying for them and could make our judgments based on the identity of the funders. They also said that this sort of spending by super PACs was going to be entirely and wholly independent of candidates or party committees. And in their view, that means it would be less corrupting because there wouldn't be any coordination between the candidates and the parties. The independent spenders might say things the candidates don't like, and it was a more core First Amendment value to spend this unlimited money if it had nothing to do with coordination with candidates and parties. The problem is, as we all know, that's not what things looked like. A lot of the money wasn't disclosed. It was given to nonprofit entities, which don't disclose their donors, and they spent the money or passed it through. And a lot of these super PACs became what we have called candidate super PACs, meaning the Romney super PAC, the Obama super PAC, the Gingrich super PAC, with very close ties between the candidates, the campaigns, and these supposedly independent groups. And the fault for all that lies with the Federal Election Commission, because the Supreme Court assumed, reading the laws, that the spending was going to be disclosed because that's what McCain-Feingold requires. And they stated that the spending was only protected and therefore unlimited if it was wholly independent. The problem is we have a government agency that is supposed to be enforcing those rules, and instead it has been undermining them, circumventing them, writing regulations which have made it easier not to disclose the spending and easier to do the sort of coordinated activities that we've seen. That's the core problem here, is that the law is not being enforced or interpreted the way the Supreme Court assumed it would be.
So when you were at the Federal Election Commission, it actually seemed to work, even though it is split between three Democrats and three Republicans. And so in that sense, is there something that changed in the nature of the FEC?
Yes, I think it did. I mean, to start with, a 3-3 agency with the legal requirement that you have to have four votes to take any action is unwieldy. There are going to be times when they deadlock with the best of intentions, but it was set up that way so that no one party could take control of the agency and use it to do harm to the other. What's happened instead, really, with the current commission is that we have ended up with the Republican leadership in Congress insisting that the president appoint people who had formerly worked for party leaders and were known to be opposed to the McCain-Feingold reform law and to favor looser enforcement of these federal rules. So it's the Republican Party in Washington, not in necessarily the country at large, but in the congressional leadership, has really ended up in a position of opposing the campaign finance regulations that we have now. And so they insisted the White House appoint three Republican commissioners who have taken that view. That means that we don't really have a partisan split so much as an ideological split. We have three commissioners who don't much believe in the law that they're supposed to enforce, and that has resulted in continual deadlocks. 3-3 ties over whether to put out notices of proposed rulemaking, 3-3 ties about what Citizens United means, 3-3 ties about when something is coordinated. Carl Rove's group, the American Crossroads, put in an advisory opinion request saying, we would like to do coordinated, non-coordinated communications. Can we do that? Which meant talk to the candidate about what's in the communications, but somehow wave a legal wand and said, it's not coordinated. And the Democrats said, of course you can't do that. The three Republicans said you can. So we had another 3-3 tie. So we've ended up with a regulatory agency that simply can't do its job.
So most of the commissioners' terms are up. Is there anything President Obama could do to change this incredible gridlock that we seem to be under here?
Yeah, that's actually one of the mysteries here, is that at the moment, five of the commissioners' terms have been up. There was one vacancy when the president got there. He nominated someone. Nothing happened. That was then withdrawn. So we've had no nominees out of the Obama White House since then, since he first got to Washington. We now have five vacancies. The problem I think the White House faces is that the tradition has been that the president gets Republican names from the Republican leadership, and he talked to the Democratic leadership in Congress about Democratic names, and then he basically appoints the people Congress asks him to. And if he does that here, there's no sign the Republicans want to get rid of the current ones, and they can stay as long as they're still living until their successors get there. But even if the Republicans gave him new names, there's no sign, unfortunately, that they would be people who believed in the law, wanted to enforce it, wanted more disclosure. So what the White House is going to have to do is very hard for them. It's going to have to really take on Congress on this and assert presidential prerogatives. This is not complicated. The Constitution says that the president shall nominate and the Senate shall review those nominations and advise and consent. But it's been turned on its head at the FEC, where the tradition is Congress nominates, gives the names of the president, and then he sends it back to Congress, which confirms. So the White House, in order to break this situation we're in now, the White House is going to have to find a way to nominate really qualified people who believe in the law on a what I would call nonpartisan or cross-partisan basis. They could do that by going out and getting respected figures from both parties to make suggestions to the White House, but I think they're going to have to take this back into their own hands and no longer rely on the congressional leadership if they want a real change at the FEC.
So I just want to remind the audience I'm speaking to Trevor Potter about the Federal Election Commission. Trevor, I have just one more question, which is organizations like Crossroads GPS, which I believe were organized under the 501c4 statute, call themselves social welfare organizations. How could that be? And most of our listeners just can't understand how the IRS could allow these people to have tax-free organizations that don't have to disclose anything. And how can this be?
Well, I think the first thing is to identify the reason for it, the game being played. And that is that if you give money to a candidate, a party, or even one of these super PACs, that does have to be disclosed as to the source and the amount of the donation. But if you give to one of these nonprofit tax-exempt groups, which are not supposed to be political committees, that's not allowed to be their major purpose, then since they're a nonprofit, they report to the IRS, not the Federal Election Commission, and they don't make public their donors. So the game here is for people who want to spend a lot of money in elections secretly to give the money to one of these C4 groups or even what's called a C6, which is a Chamber of Commerce or Business League. And those groups spend the money and they say this ad is paid for by Americans for a Better Country. And they don't tell you who is funding Americans for a Better Country. So that's why the money is going to these groups, to avoid disclosure. Now, the question, how do they get away with it? Partly it is the IRS is just very slow. It may be over time they will challenge some of these groups. But the way the IRS works is very different than the more or less contemporaneous disclosure of the FEC. You file at the IRS the year after you've engaged in all the activity, so that it could be 18 months after an election before a group actually files a tax return. And that's confidential for a while. And again, the donors are never disclosed. So it takes quite a while after an election for the IRS to even absorb what's happened here and then consider whether to challenge it. And in some cases, what seems to be going on is these groups spend money in elections, and then disappear. So they may not even file a tax return because they're not around the year after the election. So the IRS isn't designed to cope with disclosure of political spending. That's really the bottom line. By going to the IRS, these groups have gotten out of any sort of an active enforcement system. And unfortunately, because of the deadlock at the FEC isn't doing anything about it either.
Do you have any sense that this could be solved by the 2016 election?
Well, I think it could if the White House wanted it to be, because I think they could push this and make it an issue. The easiest thing to do here of everything is to get new FEC commissioners and have six commissioners who are committed to enforcing the law. Let me be clear. I think there are commissioners on that agency now who want to enforce the law, but they don't have the votes. They're deadlocked. So if the White House were to push this, the first thing they do, I think, is send good bipartisan names to Congress. The next thing they do would be to push for a recess appointment or to push the Senate to explain why they're not confirming these people, but make a public issue of it. Raise the stakes, because at the moment, no one has really heard about this or paid attention to it. And that means the status quo can stay in place. So we need some attention and leadership from the White House here if we're going to expect any quick changes. The longer-term changes might come from Congress, from changing the way the FEC is set up, but that takes legislation, and that's obviously a lot harder than the president using his constitutional prerogatives.
Well, thank you for joining us today, Trevor Potter.
You're welcome. Thanks very much for having me on.
Again, I've been speaking with Trevor Potter, who was Republican FEC commissioner from 1991 to 1995, serving as the chairman in 1994. A Washington-based lawyer, he has represented Stephen Colbert and appeared on the Colbert Report to discuss election law and Colbert's super PAC. We're going to take a brief station break, and when we return, we'll have David Lowery, the lead guitar player from Cracker and Campervan Beethoven, and we'll talk about music and intellectual property. Welcome back. I'm John Taplin, sitting in for Ian Masters. Joining us now is David Lowery, a singer, songwriter, and guitarist for the legendary alt-indie bands Cracker and Campervan Beethoven. These two bands have sold over a million records and had a dozen modern rock hits. He's also a recording producer of some notoriety, recording records for Counting Crows, Jason Molina, Magnolia Electric Company, Lucero, Sparkle Horse, and many more. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dave Lowery.
Oh, thank you. Glad to be here.
So, David, you've made some notoriety in the last 7 months when you wrote a famous letter to Emily White at All Songs Considered at NPR. Can you tell us a little bit about that, how it came about, what was going on in the culture that caused you to reach out to this young woman in what I thought was a very gentle way, but kind of a corrective way?
Well, I've been teaching a couple classes at the University of Georgia, and I sort of know the personality, not the personality, but I was really, really familiar with the fact that I was basically getting these classes of 120 students and basically with an entire computer or iPod filled with music that they'd never bought. Right, and this is a class, you know, that's basically you take if you want to get into the music business. So I had sort of started to try to sort of gently correct these people. If you expect there to be a music business, you probably should start paying for your music. So then that's in the big scheme of things how it kind of started. But I'd also started blogging about this stuff from an artist perspective a few months before that. And I'd actually written this fairly long piece called Meet the New Boss, Worse Than the Old Boss, where I just compared the revenue flows from sort of the digital distribution paradigm versus like the bad old record label system, you know, and just sort of tried to illustrate that actually artists get a lot less now, even under the best circumstances from the new digital paradigm. Even if your music is bought legally, you actually get less now than you did under the old record label system. And that caused quite a bit of controversy because it's not really the digitally correct thing to say.
Right. So who was Emily White, and what was she?
She's an intern for All Songs Considered for NPR, and they had Bob Boylan had kind of directed, I think it was Bob Boylan did this, there was a series of posts about kind of music and digital music on the NPR All Songs Considered blog. And that had been on there for several days, and I kept receiving emails from people. You have to read this intern's blog, right, what she wrote. And so I went and read it, and it was basically the story of exactly what I have in my classes, which is that I have these really big music fan students who want to be in the music business, and they haven't paid for any of their music. And so, I don't know, I got this blog forwarded to me so many times that I thought, well, you know what, I'll just write a response to this and send this to NPR. NPR didn't want to publish it, so I just put it on my blog and thought nothing else about it. And then a few days later, I guess somebody picked up on it somewhere that has quite a bit of followers, because it went totally viral after that and seemed to become sort of the topic of conversation for the next week on the internet, which is fabulous in a way.
Yeah. So let's talk a little bit about the financial basis for the big pirate sites. I mean, we see guys like Kim.com swanning around with 100-foot yachts and mansions in 3 or 4 cities. Running one of these big pirate sites like Mega Upload or Pirate Bay, it's kind of a big business, isn't it?
I think these websites, the popular file-sharing websites, are actually quite big, you know. They're full-size, I guess, enterprise-level operations.
And can you talk about how they're financed? I mean, how do they make money?
They make money in two ways. One is through charging premium subscriptions so that you get a faster download of the movies or films or music that you want. And then the other way is they serve advertising on these websites. And it's not just Russian brides and virus, you know, preventive, you know, scam programs and stuff like that. Many of the major U.S. brands and the major ad networks supply advertising to these sites.
Yeah, I mean, I've seen ads for Ford and Nationwide Insurance and BMW and Procter & Gamble on these sites. So it's not just small potatoes, right?
No, it's the major brands. I mean, I think the two brands of the big advertisers in the world that I have not seen on these sites is Coca-Cola and Apple. So apparently you can keep your ads off these sites if you're Apple and Coca-Cola. But no, I mean, I see State Farm, all the car companies are on there. It's a who's who of the Fortune 500 companies in the United States advertising on these sites.
So how do these ads get placed there? What is the ecology of this in terms of the ad networks, and who are the ad networks And are they small things or are they big corporations that
The ad networks are, in a lot of cases, I find the biggest of them all, which is Google's DoubleClick. I find them serving ads on quite a few of these sites. Not all of them, but there's still plenty of sites that are just simply for file infringement that Google is serving ads on. But I also see, like, Microsoft's, you know, companies, ad networks. I see all the major ad networks advertising on these sites. It's not the little fly-by. I mean, there's some real, sort of shoddy, small, fly-by-night sort of ad remnant networks, but largely this is the big guys advertising on these sites.
Now, do these brands know their ads are getting placed on these pirate sites, or this is, I mean, is there a really good auditing trail so brands know exactly where their ads are going?
There apparently isn't. A friend of mine jokes that it's Skynet, you know, the internet the computer network come to life in a Terminator. Because if you talk to people in the ad business, they'll tell you they can't control where the ads end up. I don't believe that's true because I told you that I don't see Coca-Cola and I don't see Apple on these ads.
Right, and obviously we don't see a lot of big brands on porn sites.
Another thing is that we see that they're able to keep these ads off of porn sites, but they can't seem to keep them off of, for instance, 4shared or any of the other major infringing sites. And by the way, there's a way to really figure out. You can go to the Google transparency reports on copyright infringement on the Google website, and they will list the top sites that have the most DMCA, basically copyright infringement notice. It's listed in order of the most, who's the worst.
It's pretty easy to figure out who the big copyright infringers are.
Yes. Well, you don't need to. It's already posted on the internet. That's what I'm saying. In the Google transparency report on this, which is a live, page you can access, you can see who this week was the number one infringer. You can see who the number 200 infringer was. But you can see which sites habitually post artists, music, and without permission.
So, Dave Lowery, where does this go? I mean, what we all went through a big huzzah last year with SOPA and PIPA, and I think a lot of people like yourself don't necessarily feel like the government has a role in this. But is there a way that the ad business could have a kind of best practices regime that would change the nature of this piracy business?
Well, let me back up, because I think actually the government does have a role in this. It's not quite the role that most people imagine. But yes, the first steps would be simply for the advertising agencies, the major brands, and the ad networks to live up to the standards that they supposedly already have. They don't, right? So what needs to be done, what we're trying to do at the Tricordist and others are trying to do, is to basically to bring this sort of ad-supported piracy, to make it public and to try to sort of embarrass the brands into stopping these practices. And there's a good, it's a challenge because some people will respond and try not to get their ads on, try to get their ads off of these sites, but then I don't know if it's somewhere between them and the advertising agency, they end up back on those sites anyway. Other people claim that they're not doing it, no matter how many screenshots or packet logs you might send them, they just assume that you're making it up. I don't know why. Or they simply, you know, some of the major brands have just basically said they're just going to keep advertising there, that they can't control where their ads end up. So they're just going to keep advertising the way they advertise.
So yourself and T-Bone Burnett, John Cougar Mellencamp, a lot of people who've had a lot of success in the business have made the statement that they're trying to keep the door open for the next generation of musicians.
Yeah.
If you were counseling a young guitar player, 18 years old in Athens, Georgia, what do you think the future of the music business is?
Well, this is something that I think you make a very good point, keeping the door open. That's a really good point, because one of the problems is that the younger generation has never known a music business where they didn't get really ripped off, you know, all the time by these sort of shyster Kim.com type people. It's the younger people, it's as if they're in a 1950s sort of version of the music business, but you don't even get the Cadillac. You know? Right?
You can't. Where's Morris Levy when we need him?
And he buys you a Cadillac. You don't even get that, you know?
Right.
And so one of the important things is that to let these younger artists who've never really grown up in a business where they were fairly compensated, to tell them that you're being ripped off, you know what I mean? And to explain to them how they're being ripped off. I look at, like, these kids in my classes, or, like, the kids, my own kids, who have, you know, a band, maybe they'll be musicians like myself one day, you know. I look at them, and I just don't want to see them ripped off by the man. Even if the man is not the same man it used to be, it's not the record companies anymore. Now it's these sort of, you know, sort of digital pirates that are the man now. And it's even legitimate companies, too.
You know, I want to touch on just one other thing that T-Bone Burnett has talked about. It, you know, today is would have been Jimi Hendrix's 70th birthday. And, you know, I remember the first time I got Are You Experienced and put it on the turntable. I had a nice Macintosh amp and some really good speakers. And T-Bone makes the contention that the sound of the analog, you know, recording on an LP was better than the MP3 sound that everybody has grown up with today. And so in some ways, he would argue that we've gone backwards in the quality of the sound people are used to. Do you have any thoughts about that?
Well, I mean, if it's done right, the digital quality is, to me, is just as good. I mean, it's a little hard if you're listening on headphones, to a stream over a 3G network on your iPhone or your Android. Yeah, it sounds pretty crappy to me. That's a pretty, like, not good experience. But it's not like it's not possible to have really high fidelity digital files. And there are services that offer that, and I know, like, you know, some artists sell higher quality digital files and stuff like that. So in a way, yeah, I think a lot of kids don't know sort of what real good fidelity, you know, recordings sound like. But I suppose, you know, I also spent a long time, you know, with a little transistor radio held up against my ear when I was, you know, 15 or 16, listening to FM radio, you know. And that probably wasn't good sound quality
right. Either.
Right,
right. I just want to end on one note. You made the point to that academics who are always arguing from the point of view what is called the copy left, that copyright is still optional. And so people who don't want their material copyrighted and who want to give it away for free and let anyone have it can do that. Can you talk a little bit about that and what a, you know, are we having a fight over something that's not necessarily needed to be fought over?
Yeah, I think a lot of the academics who are in the copy left haven't really understood that, you know, that basically what they're claiming is sort of a cultural emergency, sort of this notion that we can't freely share songs and music is not an emergency at all, and in fact it just doesn't exist. My point about copyright being optional is that you have all of these mechanisms for you can choose not to enforce your copyright, your rights under copyright as an artist. You can put your songs onto and give them away free on the internet. You could post your songs on your website and say, here, remix these however you want. You could put your songs under a Creative Commons license. So what these academics are saying is that somehow copyright law is preventing that from happening. That's why we don't have this hypothetical sort of imagined hybrid remix economy. That's not true. You can do that right now. It's not the law that's preventing that. It's just that most artists, some artists simply want to retain their rights to their songs and have the choice whether they, you know, are remixed by somebody or not. So this sort of cultural emergency that these academics have come up with, it's not an emergency at all.
Yeah, I totally agree. So I really want to thank you for talking with us.
No problem.
I just want to remind you, we've been speaking with David Lowery, the singer and songwriter, guitarist for Cracker and Kamperman Beethoven. You know, for myself, I think, you know, I wrote a book called Outlaw Blues, which you can get on iTunes, and I think it really depicts this era that Jimi Hendrix lived in which we lived or died by music. It made a lot of difference. And I think one of the things we all feel is that if the economy of the music business could be brought back by getting rid of some of the worst pirates like Kim.com, that we could once again have something of real consequence. So this has been Background Briefing. I'm Jonathan Taplin, sitting in for Ian Masters while he takes a rare and well-deserved vacation. I would like to thank my producer, Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for streaming and podcasting at ianmasters.com. And you can follow me at johntaplin.com. Background Briefing will return tomorrow at 5 p.m. with more interesting guest hosts for the rest of the week. Bye for now. Time.